Chapter 77. Though they had been aware of a third party entering the tunnel, the sudden appearance of the menacing stranger still took everyone by surprise in the Situation Room. Calamity began to loom as they helplessly watched the scene being played out deep under Gongora Hill. "General Chandler," said the President sharply, "what in hell is going on? Who is the intruder?" "We're viewing him from our monitoring unit, too, Mr. President, but the best guess he's one of Topiltzin's men. He must have penetrated from the north, where our security line is spread thin."
"He's wearing a uniform," said Brogan. "Can he be one of your men?"
"Not unless our quartermaster is issuing Israeli army battle fatigues." "Get some men down there to help Pitt," ordered General Metcalf.
"Sir, if I send a squad of men anywhere near the excavation, the mob would think we were out to either harm or capture Topiltzin. They'd go berserk."
"He's right," said Schiller. "The crowd is getting edgy."
"The intruder stole inside the tunnel under their noses," Metcalf persisted. "Why can't a couple of your men do the same?"
"It was possible 10 minutes ago, but not now," replied Chandler. "Topiltzin's crew have set up more floods. The whole slope is swimming in bright light. A rat couldn't run in there without being seen."
"The excavations face south toward the people," explained Senator Pitt. "There are no exits behind the hill."
"We're lucky as it is," Chandler continued. "The gunfire echoing from the tunnel sounded like distant thunder, and no one was sure where it came from."
The President looked at Senator Pitt darkly. "George, if the crowd begins to surge forward, we'll have to end the operation before your son can escape."
The Senator passed a hand in front of his eyes and nodded solemnly. Then he looked up at the monitor.
"Dirk will make it," he said with quiet confidence.
Nichols suddenly came to his feet and pointed at the monitor.
"The mob," he rasped despairingly. "They're moving."
While others debated his chances of survival 2,500 kilometers away, Pitt's main concern was the black mouth of the shotgun pistol. He didn't doubt for a second it was held in the hand of a man who had killed many times. The face behind the gun wore a bored expression.
Ho-hum, another one, Pitt thought.
If he didn't have his insides splashed against a wall in a few seconds, he would be crushed by tons of earth. He wasn't keen on either choice.
"You mind telling me who you are?" Pitt asked.
"I am Ibn Telmuk, close friend and servant to Suleiman Aziz Amar."
"Yes," thought Pitt, "yes."
The sight of the terrorist on the road in front of the crushing mill came back to him.
"You guys go to any length for revenge, don't you? It was his last wish that I kill you."
Pitt very slowly dropped his right arm so the sword hung down pointing at the chamber floor. He made the show of a brave man accepting defeat and relaxed his body, shoulders sagging, knees slightly bent.
"Were you on Santa Inez?"
"Yes, Suleiman Aziz and I escaped back to Egypt together."
Pitt's dark eyebrows came together. He hadn't thought it possible Amar had lived after the shootout.
God, time was running out.
Ibn should have shot him without a word, but Pitt knew the Arab was only toying with him. The blast of 50 pellets would come in the middle of a sentence. There was no reward in stalling. Pitt stared at Ibn, measuring the distance between them, figuring what direction he would leap. With casual ease, he edged the shield across his body. Capistair wrapped part of his robe around the bleeding stump, moaning from the increasing pain. Then he held up the blood-soaked cloth in front of Ibn.
"Get him!" he cried. "Look what he did to me! Shoot him down!"
"Who are you?" asked Ibn icily, without taking his eyes from Pitt.
"I am Topiltzin."
"His real name is Robert Capistair," said Pitt. "He's a colossal fraud."
Capistair scrambled over to Ibn until he was sitting at the Arab's feet.
"Don't listen to him," pleaded Capistair. "He is a common criminal."
For the first time, Ibn grinned.
"Hardly that. I've studied a file on Mr. Pitt. He's not common at anything."
Looking better, Pitt thought.
Ibn was momentarily distracted by Topiltzin. He slipped sideways a few centimeters at a time, trying to place himself so that Capistair lay between him and Ibn.
"Where is Amar?" Pitt asked abruptly.
"Dead," replied Ibn.
The grin was quickly replaced with lip-tightening anger.
"He died after killing that pig Ahmad Yazid."
The bombshell stunned Capistair. His gaze automatically turned to his brother's body in the coffin.
"So it was the man my brother hired to hijack the ship," Capistair uttered in a hoarse croak.
Pitt fought the urge to say, "I told you so," and moved another centimeter.
Ibn's eyes registered in comprehension.
"Ahmad Yazid was your brother?"
"Two peas in a pod," said Pitt.
"Would you recognize Yazid if you saw him?"
"Of course.
His appearance is as familiar as the Ayatollah Khomeini or Yasser Arafat.
Pitt's mind raced with new modifications to his desperation plan, taking advantage of the few crumbs thrown his way. Everything hinged on how well he could read Ibn's mind and predict the killer's reaction to seeing Yazid. Then take a good look in the coffin.
"Do not even think of making a move, Mr. Pitt," said Ibn.
His eyes hung warily on Pitt as he shuffled toward the coffin. When his right hip touched the pallbearer's handle, he stopped and took a quick glance inside, then back at his quarry. Pitt had not moved a centimeter. It all depended on the unexpected. Pitt planned on the classic double-take. He took the gamble that Eben's first cursory glimpse inside the coffin would cause a delayed reaction, followed by a second, longer look. And Ibn did exactly that. In the Special Operations Forces command truck, parked half a kilometer west of the excavation, Hollis, Admiral Sandecker, Lily, and Giordino gazed at a TV monitor, their attention solidly locked into the drama being acted out under Gongora Hill. Lily stood motionless, her skin eggshell white, while Sandecker and Giordino fidgeted in frustration like a pair of zoo tigers with a platter of fresh meat just beyond reach of their cage. Hollis was pacing the small enclosure, nervously clutching a small ultra-high-frequency detonation transmitter in one hand while the other held a phone receiver. He was shouting at an aide of General Chandler's, "Like hell I'll detonate, not until the crowd passes the danger perimeter." "They've moved too close now," the aide, a colonel, countered. "Another 30 seconds," snapped Hollis, "not before." "General Chandler wants that hill blown now," demanded the colonel, his voice rising. "That's an order that comes from the president."
"You're only a voice over a phone, Colonel," Hollis stalled. "I want the order direct from the President."
"You're asking for a court-martial, Colonel."
"It won't be the first time."
Sandecker shook his head fearfully.
"Dirk will never make it, not now."
"Can't you do something?" pleaded Lily. "Talk to him. He can hear you over the speaker connected to the TV camera."
"We don't dare distract him," answered Hollis. "Break his concentration and that Arab will kill him."
"That's it," Giordino muttered, infuriated.
He tore out the command truck door, jumped to the ground, and dashed over to Sam Trinity's jeep. Before Hollis's men could stop him, the car was bouncing through the brush toward Gongora Hill. In one quick leap, Pitt uncoiled like a rattler and drove the shield against Ibn. The sword blurred and slashed again. His muscled arm swung with all the strength of his shoulder behind it. He felt and heard the blade edge clang against metal before it struck something soft. An explosion went off, seemingly in his face. He flinched as the main force of the blast struck the middle of his shield and ricocheted against the rock ceiling. The armored plastic sheeting that had been riveted to the laminated wood by Major Dillinger that afternoon was dented but not penetrated. Pitt's sword hand finished the arc, and he launched a murderous backhand swing. Ibn was fast, but his shock at seeing Yazid cost him a precious second. He caught Pitt's attack out of the corner of one eye and squeezed off a badly aimed snapshot before the sword blade glanced off the breech of the shotgun and sliced through his hand, severing his thumb and fingers just behind the knuckles. Ibn uttered a ghastly groan. The pistolized shotgun clattered to the hard limestone floor almost on top of the Colt Python still gripped in Capister's severed hand. But Ibn recovered enough to duck away from Pitt's slashing swing. Then, in one violent twisting motion, he lunged at Pitt. Pitt was ready for the assault, but as he dodged to one side, his right leg folded under him. In a flashing instant, he realized that one or two of the shotgun's pellets had missed the shield and struck him in the same leg that had been wounded on Santa Ynez Island. Before he could react and dance away, Ibn dropped on him like a panther. The black eyes gleamed satanically under the string of lights, the teeth ghoulishly bared. Pitt lost his grip on the sword hilt as Ibn knocked it away. His other arm was trapped under the inside straps of the shield. Then, slowly, deliberately, Eben's good hand closed around Pitt's throat.
"Kill him!" Robert Capister shrieked repeatedly like a madman. "Kill him!"
Pitt heaved in a corkscrew motion and brought his fist up from the floor, striking Ibn in the Adam's apple. With the cartilage of the larynx crushed, most men would have gagged to death. The rest should have at least gone unconscious. Ibn did neither. He simply clutched his throat, made a terrible gurgling voice, and reeled backward. They both struggled drunkenly to their feet, Pitt hopping on one leg, Ibn gasping for air, his mangled right hand hanging useless. They stood there, facing each other like wounded pit bulls catching their breath for the next round, warily eyeing each other to see who would make the first move. It came from an unexpected quarter. Capister suddenly came to his senses and threw himself on the colt, frantically struggling one-handed to pry the frozen fingers from the grip. The dead hand fell away. Then, like a game of musical chairs, Capister's grab triggered a like response from Eben and Pitt. They quickly looked around for the weapons nearest them. Pitt lost. The shotgun was in Eben's corner. So was the Roman sword. Any port in a storm, Pitt thought. He kicked out wildly with the foot of his wounded leg, connecting with Capister's rib cage, but suffering a grinding pain from the effort. He also hurled the shield like a frisbee at Eben, striking the Arab on the stomach and knocking the wind out of him. A loud wailing cry gushed from Capister's lips. He dropped the Colt and Pitt caught it in midair. It was a near-perfect catch. His hand slipped around the bloodied grip and his finger through the trigger guard. Eben, doubled over by the blow from the shield, was still awkwardly lifting the pistolized shotgun with his left hand when Pitt fired. Pitt tightened his grip for the next recoil. The Arab stumbled backward against the chamber wall, and then his body fell forward onto the floor and his head struck with a repugnant thud. Pitt stood panting through clenched teeth. Only then did he hear a frantic voice shout through the speaker on the TV camera. "Get out of there!" Hollis was yelling. "For Jesus' sake, run for it!" Pitt was temporarily disoriented. He was so busy fighting Eben he forgot which passage led to the easier tunnel entrance and which to the more difficult open crater exit. He took a last fleeting glimpse of Robert Capister. The face was ashen from the loss of blood, but not, Pitt saw, with fear. Hate filled the eyes of Topiltzen. "Enjoy your trip to hell," Pitt said. Capister's reply was the smoke bomb. He had somehow pulled the primer pin. Smoke instantly burst and filled the interior of the chamber with a densely packed orange cloud. "What happened?" the president asked, staring at the strange orange mist that blocked out the camera view of the chamber. "Capister must have been carrying some kind of a smoke warning device," Chandler answered. "Why haven't the explosives gone off?" "One moment, Mr. President." Chandler looked off camera and conversed angrily with an aide. Then he turned back. "Colonel Hollis of the Special Operations Forces insists on a direct order from you, sir." "Is he in charge of the detonation?" demanded Metcalf. "Yes, General." "Can you patch him into our communications network?" "One moment." 4 seconds was all it took before Hollis's face was peering from one of the monitors in the Situation Room. "I realize you can't see me, Colonel," said the President, "but you recognize my voice." "I do, sir," Hollis answered through tight lips. "As your Commander-in-Chief, I'm ordering you to blow that hill, and blow it now." "The mob is swarming up the hill," Nichols said in near panic. They all tensed and swung their eyes to the monitor sweeping the hill. The huge throng was slowly moving up the slope toward the summit, chanting Topiltzen's name. "If you wait any longer, you'll kill a lot of people," said Metcalf urgently. "For pity's sake, man, detonate!" Hollis's thumb was poised above the switch. He spoke into his transmitter. "Detonation!" But he didn't press the switch. He used the enlisted man's gambit. Never refuse an order and be tried for insubordination, but answer to the affirmative and never carry it out. Inefficiency was one of the most difficult of charges to prove at a court-martial. He was determined to squeeze every second he could for Pitt. Holding his breath as though he were diving underwater, eyes tightly closed against the stinging smoke, Pitt willed his legs to move, to run, to crawl, to do anything which would rush him clear of that horror chamber. He made it into a passage, not knowing if it led to the tunnel shaft or the crater. He kept his eyes shut, feeling his way along the wall, half-hopping, half-hobbling on his bad leg. He felt a burning rage to live. He simply couldn't believe he'd die now, not after having survived the last few minutes. Finally, he opened his eyes. They burned as if stung by bees, but he could see. He had passed the worst of the smoke. It was only an orange vapor now. The shaft through the limestone began to rise. He felt a slight increase in temperature and a light breeze. Then he stumbled outside into the night. The stars were there, almost blotted out by the bright lights shining up the hill. But Pitt was not clear. There was a snag. He had the unsettling realization that he had exited through the crater tunnel. The slanting sides rose up another 5 meters, so close yet so tormentingly far. He began clawing his way up the incline, his wounded leg, totally useless now, dragging along behind. He could only dig in and push with one foot. Hollis had gone silent. The colonel had no words left to say. Pitt knew the explosion he'd so carefully planned was going to take him with it. Fatigue swept over him in great floating waves, yet he stubbornly crawled upward. Then a dark form appeared over the rim of the crater, and a massive hand reached down, grabbed the shoulder of Pitt's sweater, and heaved him onto level ground. With seemingly incredible ease, Giordino threw Pitt into the open tailgate of the jeep, leapt into the driver's seat, and jammed the accelerator pedal flat onto the floorboard. They had barely covered 50 meters when Hollis pressed the demolition switch. The ultra-high-frequency signal set off the 200 kilograms of C6 nitroglycerin gel deep inside the hill with a monstrous roar. For one brief moment, it was as if a volcanic eruption was about to hurtle from the bowels of the earth. The hill shook with a terrifying rumble. The great mass of Topiltzin followers were thrown to the ground, their mouths agape in horror, the concussion sucking the air from their lungs into a vacuum. Then the whole summit of Gongora Hill rose almost 10 meters into the air, hung there in the night as if clutched by a giant hand, and crumbled and fell inward, leaving a huge plume of billowing dust as a ghostly tombstone.